This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on location in Virginia with Nin Andrews. She's here to premiere her new memoir, and she has distinguished herself for years in poetry. We know her name is like a meteor, and now we're going to hear her prose poems. So, Nin, tell us a little bit about Son of a Bird, memoir and prose poems, and what we're going to hear.
Well, Son of a Bird is a memoir. Obviously, it's in the title. And it's a collection of prose poems about my childhood. I've always wanted to write about my childhood, but I've never really been able to. I've always had so many questions about my past. I think everyone does, about how do you put it on the page? And it finally dawned on me that prose poems are actually the perfect, genre. I mean, I think of prose poems as like slides, and I think our memory is like a slideshow. I don't know if people know what slides are anymore, but there used to be, and Kodak used to make these little slides. They were little pieces of cellophane framed by white cardboard. And if you held them up to the light, you would see an image, a vivid scene in miniature. And if you shone a light through them, you could, you know, project it onto the wall. And you could arrange these slides in a sequence, much like splicing together frames of a film, and a narrative would unfold. But around the flames, of course, around slides, there's darkness, there's forgetfulness, all that's not recollected, which is also interesting. And it's why I think poetry replicates memory better than, say, nonfiction. In other words, I think memory operates not as a straight line, not as an unbroken flow of text, but sort of like a constellation of illuminated moments.
That's what we get here. That's what we get. And we're going to hear each of the illuminated moments. First of all, you said your prologue was not a prose poem, but you know, actually it is, Nin. It is. But let's hear it. Let's hear the prologue. This is Nin Andrews. She is sweet. She is sad. She is funny. She is inimitable.
Okay. Dear past self, when I visited my childhood home last week, I could see you in the windows of our stone farmhouse with your pink glasses and tiny eyes. No, you weren't ever that small, but that's how I see you now, as small as Thumbelina, and our house too, and the barns where the horses and chickens slept, where the kittens and foals were born each spring. Once, when the horses kicked their stalls and whinnied in the night, you ran barefoot in the dark, flashlight in hand to check on them, and back in bed, unable to sleep and out of breath, you wrote, "Dear future me," in script, imagining me now. That was the night Dad's horse Ella died. We phoned the vet, but by the time he arrived, Ella was dead. You tried to think of other things, like how you wanted to grow up and be a horse, or the fastest runner on earth, or the best high jumper. That's what you wish for on every birthday star and on every point of pie, which you save to eat last, because otherwise your wish wouldn't come true, at least according to your dad. You practiced eating grass, whinnying, trotting, cantering, and galloping before jumping all the horse jumps, one by one. Sometimes you fell and skinned your knees or banged your head, but you kept practicing until your legs ached and you were soaked with sweat. But still you couldn't sleep. "Dear future me," you wrote in entry after entry, "please come back, don't forget. Write about me, about the horse I am or almost am. Only make me prettier and fast. Back then you didn't love you very much and hoped I'd make you better after the fact. Which is strange, I think, for a child. Strange also to be an insomniac, already staring out the window at the dark, afraid of sickness and death and old age, already picturing yourself as an old woman looking back or down, like an owl swooping over the fields of the past, memories like scared mice scampering through the grass."
The voice of Nin Andrews. That is such a powerful beginning. We're so glad you had this compulsion to put this down, these snapshots, these slides, these postcards. We're going to go back and forth across time in this talk, although I think it may be sequential in the book, right? Is it chronological in the memoir?
Theoretically. Yeah. I mean, I think we frame our recollections and they often get out of sequence according to what is the emotional resonance of what we're saying. I think to the best of my knowledge.
Oh, well, we'll find out as we hear it. But take us to another part of your life and let's keep going. Nin Andrews.
Okay, so I had a very unusual mother. She was probably on the autism spectrum. She was a dairy farmer and also a classics scholar. She had this very unique view of the world in which she compared everything either to ancient Greek mythology or her heifers. So this next one, they don't have titles in the book, but this could be called Little Lesbians. I was in sixth grade when I curled Stephanie Combs' hair around my colored pencils in English class. My teacher, Mrs. Ward, tapped me on the shoulder with her orange fingernails. "Come with me," she hissed and pulled me into the hallway. "You have to stop touching that girl's hair. I'm beginning to worry you're a lesbian." She sent a note home that day, carefully tucked in an envelope, with the inscription, "A private matter for Mrs., not Mr. Hayward, to discuss with Nin." "Heavens," my mother said. "All little girls are lesbians." She tossed the note in the garbage. "Were you a lesbian?" I asked. "I was a little lesbian," she said. "I had crushes on girls, but I wasn't really lesbian." "How do you know?" I asked. She shrugged. "It's just like the heifers. They start humping each other in the springtime." "Cows are lesbians?" I asked. "It's genetic," she shrugged. "Some of us get more of the lesbian and some less. Time will tell how much of the lesbian you possess." "How will it tell?" My mother sighed, her silver blue glasses sliding down her nose. "If you are in your 20s and you still want to play with Stephanie's hair, well then, you're a lesbian." "Not a hairdresser?" My mother stared at me blankly. "I do hope you're not a hairdresser."
Oh, Nin, that is part of you that we have known for years. That is hilarious. But we have a portrait there, actually, as well as an anecdote, of a mother who is truly not a Betty Crocker in a ruffled apron, right?
Not at all.
No, she was something else. And do you think that that's exactly as it happened, that you were able to capture it, that dialogue?
I do. She was a character.
Well, and so unbridled. I mean, did you have other conversations with her that were just as stark and stunning?
Oh, always. I mean, she was just cut to the chase. You know, don't waste time.
Did she also cook? And was she domestic?
Oh no.
She was intellectual. Oh, I'm getting the picture of her, because it's interesting. That small interchange gives us a real picture of her and your relationship. Nin Andrews is the author of 15 poetry collections, including this latest collection, Son of a Bird, a memoir in prose poems, published just now by Etruscan Press. And so we're going to go forward and further about your life. So juicy.
Okay. So you were asking if my mother was domestic. She was neither domestic nor particularly maternal. I was the sixth child, and I was raised first by a nanny who died when I was about five, and then farmhands. My earliest memories are primarily about other people, not my parents, and my siblings, of course. So my nanny's name was Mary. After Mary, my nanny left one day and never returned. It was years before I learned she was dead. Off at the barn with the one-armed farmhand and Korean war vet, Mr. Shaver. "If a farmhand can look after heifers, he can look after you too," she said, mm-hmm. before driving off in a cloud of dust. Mr. Shaver leaned against the red farm truck, smoking, and eyed me up and down. "Now what are we gonna do with you?" he asked. I started to sob. He patted me on the head. "Ah, hush now. It's all right, little gal. Look, I got something for you." He slid his artificial arm out of his sleeve and handed it to me. Showed me how to screw in the fork and knife attachments, fishing dirty marshmallows out of his pocket with his oil-stained hand. I sat in the grass and stabbed marshmallows with a fork and knife and watched Mr. Shaver's son, Bud, muck stalls. Mr. Shaver smoked Marlboros or chewed on the sweet ends of meadow grass and talked. He asked me, did I want to toss horseshoes or learn to blow tunes on a pop bottle? And was Jesus my friend? I shook my head and held on to his arm, rocking it like a baby doll.
Oh, that is so incredibly sweet and sad. And was that seared into your mind so that it has always been there, or did it visit you as you were recollecting? Did it pop up, or is this something you often thought about?
No, it was that particular drop off moment is seared into my memory. And the arm, I loved that arm. He didn't like it very much. He said it didn't fit right, and Uncle Sam was going to send him another one, but it just had never did arrive. And I just thought that arm was the coolest thing.
So does he think the arm accessed memory, or that it visited you? That arm is really seminal in the writing because it's something false and something true happening. We have a wooden arm, but we have a true merciful experience. So the contrast is profound, even though you're just telling a little story.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Just because I'm a gossip, where were your parents by the time there was a sixth child? Was their curiosity satisfied? Were they had professions, I guess.
So mom couldn't sit still. She was like a bird. The title is both. I was called son of a bird when I was bad by my nanny. I was either little P when I was good or son of a bird. She'd be hollering, "Where's my son of a bird?" And then my mother was very avian. She was just always restless. She couldn't sit still for a minute, and always had to be doing something, whether she was gardening or hiking or fussing with the heifers, or she never did anything in a small way. So she lectured on dairy farming techniques. She traveled around. I mean, as a woman, you know, she was born in 1918. You know, she lectured against the hormones that they put in dairy cat in milk and how they affected the cows and gave them mastitis and all these things. But she was a force in the world.
Wow. She was a maverick, wasn't she?
Was. And the funny thing, like, she'd be talking to farmers and she'd make allusions to ancient Greek as well. I mean, she's always
But she was a good role model.
She was a very interesting role model.
But don't you think that you benefited from some way? Because I like to think that. I was a career woman, and I like to think my children, if dinner was late, that they still had someone they knew could go out in the world.
Oh, yeah. Yes. I mean, she also was a political activist and never hesitated to speak her mind.
And I wonder where... Wonder how that got passed on. This is Nin, and you know, I don't think in the book you explain the title.
No, Mary calls me son of a bird. Yes, she does.
Oh, okay. But because I didn't read that part, but I will soon. This is a new book just out by Etruscan Press, and take us further and farther.
Okay.
I want to tell some people about how important you are. Recipient of 2 Ohio Artists Awards, the Wick Chapbook Prize, the Ohioana Award, the Gerald Cable Award. Work has been in many, many prestigious journals, Best American Poetry, Great American Prose Poems, From Poe to the Present, Best American Erotic Poems, and I have to say, this is so true. Agni, the Paris Review, the best. Here she is.
Okay, so on the subject of farmhands, my father was always trying to teach the farmhands to read, and he wasn't very successful, but I wasn't allowed to watch. So, of course, if you're not allowed to do something, you do it. So I would spy on him, and he would teach them on the this green chalkboard that was in the tack room, and there was a hayloft above it, and you could look down through it, and he'd have that yellow chalk on that green chalkboard. I still love yellow chalk on a green chalkboard. But anyway, and so he'd be teaching them. The summer I turned 5, my father decided to teach the farmhands to read. I lay on my belly in the loft and peeked through the broken slats spying on them, writing with yellow chalk on the green blackboard that hung outside the tack room. My father, an architect, drew perfect geometric letters, each a little building I wanted to crawl inside. Every day he lined the letters up. A, at, bat, understand, he asked. Anyone want to write cat? He handed the chalk to one of the men who ran his fingers through his oiled hair, leaving tracks like a plowed field. Can't teach this old dog, he said, and nodded at Bud, the farmhand's son, standing beside him. That young'un neither. 16 years old, Bud blushed, shame scalding his skin. He'd been working on the farm since he was 12. I remember the day he hid in the hayloft when the truant officer stopped by. You seen that shaver boy, he asked me. I shook my head. No, sir. You know it's a sin to lie, he asked. I suspiciously, yes, sir, but I haven't seen hide nor hair of Bud Shaver, I said, lifting my palms to the sky. Bud's back curled forward like a question mark. I wondered if he was crying. Don't worry, son, my father said. Then he wrote on the board, I sit in shit. He read the words out loud. The men burst out laughing. That word's shit? Bud asked, pointing at the chalkboard. My father nodded and explained the SH makes a shh sound. That's when before my eyes, the letters became words, became meaning. Like hay bales, I could move them around to build a fort or a house with windows and doors. I couldn't wait for the men to leave when I climbed down the ladder and slid the saddle washing stool beneath the chalkboard, balanced on the soap sticky wood, and wrote an I, an in, a nin. Then erased them and started all over again.
An I, N, an nin, and started all over again. Well, I think that that was a kind of a hard way to learn the letter S. Your father was an imaginative educator, I have to say that. Now, you're the youngest of 6, so did they experience growing up the way you did and learning the way? Now, a poet, a born poet, and we know that writers are born wired a certain way, have a certain sensibility. So you would be different from your 5 other siblings, but did they experience any of the learning that you did in the same way, or were you just really singular?
I don't think so. There were different levels of abandonment depending on, they were 6 years and 9 years. But yes, so I was more feral than the rest. And my sister, 2 years older, was the next most feral. So there was a, yes, yeah, so, but there was a lot, none of them were coddled. So we all had a bit of wildness. Maybe the oldest is the most tame. But yeah, I think so. I mean, it wasn't
you
all.
Think you're different? Do you think you're different from the other 5?
Yes and no. I think that we're all very much a tribe. All of us are very old. Yeah. You know, so all of us are on the creative side.
Oh, really?
But, yes. Yes.
All 6 of you are creative.
All 6 are creative. Yes.
Same DNA, so. I guess. Those 2 parents were really something else.
They really encouraged. They wanted us to be artistic. They encouraged it.
Oh, that was good. You know, today's the first day I've ever noticed your Southern accent.
I know, you know, my mother corrected it all the time, and so I grew up with 2 accents, one in front of my mom and one in front of my dad, and I would shift because I'm a born mimic, and that's also why I remember what the farmhands would say and all those things, because I would just mimic, and I would get in a lot of trouble at school because I would repeat what I heard as insults at the barn, you know. I could sling them. So yeah, so
Have you ever written a play? Because
no,
dialogue,
haven't.
I mean, you're just a born playwright.
Oh,
maybe that's what's next. Maybe Son of a Bird could be a play.
Oh, that
it has the characters, don't you think?
It does have characters, yes.
Well, of course, I think that once the book is gelled, it is gelled, and it's its own thing. And you've created something that will your life will go longer than you will because of this book, which is the amazing thing about writing. And are you happy with the book?
I am happy with it. Yes, I am. I'm never completely happy with anything I've done. I'm still like that kid with the eraser. Let me start all over again. There are things, you know, little tiny things that irk me. But I'm happy that this was a hard book for me to write. And so I'm happy that I did it.
How long did it take?
It took about 3 years, I think. But I was thinking about it way longer than that and I couldn't like figure out like how I was going to put it together.
Well, let us hear more from Son of a Bird.
So one of the things about my parents was my father was gay and my mother always knew he was gay. It was never a secret. You know, there are lots of stories about people. Oh, I married someone. I found out they were gay. And there's all this drama around that. But this was not like that at all. And I found out that my dad was gay when I was 9 years old because I found love letters in his sock drawer from a man. And my parents explained it very matter-of-factly. And I remember thinking it was very logical. It was homosexuality. It was just like Ken preferring Mr. Potato Head to Barbie. I mean, it made sense to me. But I had questions. And I like to ask my mom, well, how did you meet? And how did it, you know, without like, was it romantic or how does this work? And my mom would sort of facetiously, once or twice, she told me rather facetiously, well, once upon a time, so she's telling me how the proposal happened. And the sort of the one thing that is in here, but been in therapy for homosexuality. I don't know what you would have called it. We call it conversion therapy. I don't know what they called it. But in order to cure his homosexuality, because he'd been kicked out of the Navy for having an affair. So that's a lot of backstory. Once upon a time, your father announced that he was cured, my mother explained. This was long ago on one of our last dates. I was a school teacher in Boston, and he was living in New York City doing some kind of conversion therapy, seeing a real quack. We were dining at the Automat, Horn and Hardart. I'd selected the meatloaf and baby braised carrots. He was eating Salisbury steak with a side of cream spinach. I handed him a napkin. His lips were green. Cured, I asked. Isn't that what you do to a ham? He didn't laugh. He asked me to marry him, got down on one knee right there beside the table. It was so embarrassing. I guess he was trying to be romantic. I said yes, as long as he was certain he could produce offspring. This was the late 40s. A lot of women married homosexuals back then.
That curtain line is really interesting. What do you think the reader knows about your mother, that she is idealistic, that she's over self-confident, that she is an adventurer to embark on that, a believer? What do you think the reader knows?
Well, my mother, you know, I think it's one of the beauties of being on the spectrum, which I talk about. She was very logical. She was just a pragmatist. She wanted children. She thought he was a decent fella, and she often compared him to a very good bull.
There are worse analogies.
He could time the births of her children just like she timed the heifer's pregnancies. He was very reliable. So she had us on a schedule, and he performed perfectly. It all went well, as far as she was concerned.
I love that. I love that, yeah. But that isn't in the book. That's an outside prose poem. One of your, that would be for another kind of book, because that is amazing and it's true, which makes it all the more amazing. So you said that you had kind of a hard time imagining how these should be put together. How did they decide to be put together, to move? How did you organize time? When I wrote my memoir, I just got up in the morning. I thought, PBS, I'll write 2 pages on PBS. Oh, the next morning I remembered NEH, but this is not quite the same.
Right. So I organized it around the question, what happened to me? You know, like I had a certain, I really loved my parents, but I had a lot of difficulty growing up. And some of it was because I was a medical guinea pig as a child. I had surgeries on my eyes from the time I was born until I was 13. And I would go to Boston Children's for evaluations and be dropped off by my mother with the medical team. And gave me a lot of nightmares. I didn't do well in the surgeries, and it gave me visions of things that recurred in my dreams and my sleep. So I was very troubled. I always, by the time I knew about psychiatry, by the time I discovered that there was help out there, I wanted it. And I struggled with this sort of other ethereal world that was very much in my vision, literally and figuratively, and it troubled me day and night. So I was in the world. I was also in this other sort of aspect. So in writing the book, I didn't know how to put all that together. And so I started writing it when my son was very ill, and it brought back all those memories. So I started it there with that sort of childhood, and then put together, you know, the parents, and trying to put together the little dots that to understand how my psyche worked and how I became who I am today, sort of. I mean, it's sort of like, it really just goes to college, but it dealing with the different influences that were very, very important in my life. So I sort of went from influence to influence. So I started with
a very good explanation. I understand that very, very well. But your illnesses are a contribution to the world, because they gave you a different way of seeing and knowing, and you're able to make permanent on the page. That is really a gift, a gift. And your poetry has been translated into Turkish, performed in Prague, and anthologized in England, Australia, and Mongolia. And you are editor of a book of translations of the Belgian writer Henri Michaux. Let us have a final piece from Son of a Bird.
So this next one is just how the book really started, and it's just referring to the fact that I've been carrying this book inside me for years, just not knowing really how to access it. It started when I was in college, after I left the family farm, this habit I have of keeping a book inside my chest, an illustrated text complete with drawings, photos, fantasies, memories, poems, old letters. But no one has ever read it. I suspect everyone has one, that they're as common as prayer books left in churches with black moleskin covers. In dreams, I find myself turning the pages, folding the corners, underlining passages. I can still see it in the mirror when I wake up, but of course all the words are backwards, and in the morning light they drift away like schools of tiny black fish.
And because we are greedy, I'm going to ask you to add another bit of the book before we say goodbye.
Okay, well, I'll just read the one that follows that. Mornings, I wash my face, put on my glasses, and lean in, squinting to take a closer look at my pages before the words become illegible. I try to translate them as if they're a foreign language, but some have no meaning. I don't even know where the book begins. If I go back too far, the pages disintegrate or turn into winged insects, termites, bees, moss. What is the price of letting them disappear? And what are the drawings? They're the oceans my father watercolored so many times, each one tossed aside, curling up on the porch like an abandoned thought. A perfectionist, nothing was ever good enough for my father. My mother's cows graze on the rolling hillside. On the lawn below him, my sisters hold hands in a game of Rover, Rover, Red Rover. They look so drippy and faint, as if the sky were crying overhead. I dare you to come over, one calls and sticks out her tongue. The colors brighten as they tighten their grips.
The voice of Nin Andrews. This is a poet and the poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production. Post-production by Mike Turbin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipet Fund, the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family, and by friends of the program, Natalie Canavor and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Mike Turpin's our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.